It's Bill Teeple, Alan Cobb, and Donna Colby, and it's Icon Art Radio. Well, last time we left it at the intersection of expression and communication. Would you want to recap what you were discussing?
Yeah, I guess what I was thinking was that, and maybe the Picasso example is the best one, because it's fairly commonly known. You know, he paints a painting like the Guernica, which is a really dramatic and huge, almost monstrous statement. Now, calling it a statement suggests that there's another person there who hears the statement. But from the artist's standpoint, usually, in the case of a painting, it's being done in private. And once the once he has expressed himself onto the canvas, he's finished his process. Then somebody looks at the canvas and says, oh, well, that's a cartoon. And now we have a communication. Picasso made a cartoon, and the person looked at it and said, yep, it's a cartoon. Someone else looks at it and says, that is monstrous. And now we have a different communication. A third person looks at it and says, this is an astonishing manifestation of Picasso's vision taken a few steps further in a direction I hadn't expected. And the subtlety that I see in that is mind-boggling. And the energy that it projects in condemnation of war is utterly stupendous. And everyone should see this because it's really important. There's another communication. And I think what this shows is that the communication is actually in the observer. Mm-hmm. It's not in the artist. The artist is one end of an array of intelligence that begins at the artist and ends at the audience, the individual member of the audience. And a communication is really the audience end of that line, and the expression is the artist end of that line.
And in viewing a work of art, too, it isn't just different people, but you're yourself at different times. You know,
right.
You go and see the same painting when you're 10 years old, it communicates something to you. You see it when you're 16, it communicates something else. Every time you look at that painting, you may have some, it may open a different doorway because it sparks some different aspect in you. Or you may even know more at a certain time of what the artist's intention was, and that also adds to it. So it's a,
or just being a different frame of mind.
Right, a different.
So throughout my lifetime, I've always kind of looked at this whole game as one large process of miscommunication, mm-hmm. and that every now and then, some connection is actually made. Now, is it the artists that are adept in expressing universal ideas to the extent that communication is actually almost or somewhat made occasionally around these things?
Sure. I think that's sort of why what we consider to be the essential ingredient in art that survives for generations, the so-called great art, is great because of its universality. It doesn't mean that there wasn't, in a sense, equally great art in every other aspect that simply was more specialized. It required a different kind of person to see it and get it. And so, in a sense, it's almost coincidental. Because I'm not sure that an artist is any less universal in expressing something very, very, very refined and particular. But it may be that the audience for it is very small. You know, the audience for Bartok is smaller than the audience for Tchaikovsky. Does that make Bartok less great? No, but it makes him performed a lot less.
But I think that the aha or the beauty in both of them is a universal thing.
Oh, sure.
And some of it is just a mystique, I think, that creates something universal that nobody even really understands, but everybody, like the Mona Lisa is a good example, you know. Mm-hmm. There are people who go and see the Mona Lisa and say, it's just so, it's so small, it's just this. And yet, you know, there are more people crowding around the Mona Lisa than any other painting in the Louvre because you've got to see the Mona Lisa. And if you're standing there in front of it, looking at it, there is something amazing that, you know, you sort of think in your mind, this isn't just the myth, you know, this isn't just because it's so famous. There's something in that painting that caused the myth in the first place.
Right.
But scholars have argued, you know, for centuries as to what exactly it is. And that's the mystery, you know, it's not just the mystery of the smile, it's something else. What is it about the Mona Lisa that makes it communicate something that people want to keep tapping into every time they go there?
Well, I think he's the one of the best examples of a multi-layered, multi-dimensional artist that touched more aspects of universal truth than any other artist that has lived.
Yeah.
So that's the mystery here. It's your own mystery.
Yeah, right.
And someone's given some expression to it.
Yeah, just to discover that someone can do what, you know, what's really possible for a human life to accomplish is stunning. It's shocking. I remember going to see the Mona Lisa with Lawrence. We were just returning to Switzerland and stopped briefly in Paris and rented a car and drove as fast as we could to the Louvre and parked on the sidewalk and ran inside and ran up the stairs past the Winged Victory of Samothrace and took a quick look at the Mona Lisa and stood there sort of sucking as much of it into our eyes as we could because we knew we were going to get busted for parking and we were going to be late for our plane. And after about 5 minutes, you know, the guards began converging on us. We happened to be there at a time when it was deserted, but some guards began to converge to get us to, you know, you can't look at the Mona Lisa more than 5 minutes. And so we ran back down the stairs and went back to the airport. And that's all we did in Paris. It was 5 minutes in front of the Mona Lisa. But it really, I don't know, it has become... it's become an icon. It represents, you know, a level of creative achievement that's almost unprecedented. There's hardly anyone has ever been that creative, and especially in such colorful and accessible media. I think maybe Benjamin Franklin is a good competition, but. He wasn't a painter, and most of what he did, you know, isn't known about. And he certainly didn't do quite as much.
My kids had a children's book about Da Vinci.
Yeah.
And it was the most wonderful because it was a story about him as a little child and how he would go and he'd study nature and he'd do all the, and he'd say, I'm going to be a botanist. And his father was so proud of him because his child was going to grow up to be a botanist. And then his father would go away on a business trip and come back and he was like building machines, you know, and then his father said, oh, well, that's okay. He's going to be an engineer, you know. And every time the story goes on, and every time his father would come back, he was like doing something entirely different and was completely into it. And after a while, his father got really worried that his son was going to be an utter failure because he
dilettante.
Kept changing his mind all the time.
Yeah.
And then they had a wonderful ending in the book when his father finally realized that his son was a genius. And so it was a great, to me, that was a great message to give to children, to encourage them to exercise their creativity and experiment.
Sure.
And pursue growth instead of deciding, because everybody's always asking a little kid, what do you want to be when you grow up? As if when you're 4 years old, you're supposed to know.
Yeah. I've always felt very sort of envious of people who knew what they wanted to be and were able to just go after that. Because I've known all my life that I have no idea what I should be, or and I don't know what I want to be. And I guess now I'm being what I want to be, which means I compose music part of the time and write poetry part of the time and build strange inventions part of the time and build movable walls part of the time.
So have you figured out yet, Bill, what you want to be when you grow up?
I didn't have much choice, I don't think. I just was on a track and I've been riding that one.
Yeah, I really
although I've would like I've to... I've left I've gone this way and that to try to add more elements of the whole to it, but I've been on this art thing pretty much all along.
However, it has changed, as you talked in one of the other shows about how, you know, the direction, like.
Well, I might have thought at one point that I was going to be a landscape painter, and at one point I thought I was going to be a sculptor, and at one point I thought I was going to be a pop artist, and at one point I was going to be a conceptual artist. I mean, I've tried it. Then I realized that, and this is sort of what we're discussing here, that wanting to not leave anything out of the picture has driven my path as an artist. And once I got here 8 or 9 years ago, I had decided I was going to surrender to the whole thing because I've been trying to get off of that onto even more larger global and universal issues. I was going to surrender to the necessity of my umbilical connection to the art world and do it full on. And so I thought that meant, you know, make some drawings and paintings and put them in galleries and be an artist for a while and make these commodities and do something with them. Only to find that God had in store more of the same, which was to make me a more universal artistic person, and that meant including not only being one, but understanding it intellectually enough to explain it to others as a teacher, and then become a orchestrator of the ritual happening, where the objects of the artifacts of these creative processes are experienced by the community or the group.
So this is exactly like what the subject we started out with is thinking. The difference between expression and communication. What you're talking about is your role as that you've come into here in Fairfield is a unity of both of those things. Your expression is communication to the
right.
Public.
Well, this is where we began today. Expression and communication is the story of art. The artist keeps moving forward. He keeps expressing, and he keeps being a process, a creative process. Out of this process fall these physical objects, these artifacts, these sparks of the process that lay behind him.
That's a great image.
And their batteries, this person, if he's on a track of self-discovery and driving into manifestation, his deepest and most unified cognitions is leaving these little artifacts behind that are little batteries or little holders of where he was at that particular moment. Well, my job in recent years has been to collect these things up and put them in create a situation where the optimum communication and communion and connection and enlivening in the group of this power can take place.
This is so cool because this then circles back to the question that we raised two shows ago about what it is that causes a person to want to make art. And so there are these two elements. It seems like both of these elements are part of why a person wants to create art, no matter who they are. The expression and the connection, which is even more than communication, is the connection to other people and to the universe.
Yeah, some artists put their focus on connecting with the audience. And you know, the performing arts certainly are an opportunity to express yourself creatively and have a very dynamic, powerful connection with a living audience in real time. And you know, the painter is in a more, you know, timeless circumstance, and the painting and the audience may be separated by, unfortunately, a generation or two. The artist may never know the audience that he's connecting with. And we have far too many examples of that, because so many of the great artists were ahead of their time. But that's, you know, that's a continuum. And so, you know, by choosing teaching, Bill has created a situation where he's in very, very close connection with the observer, and the art form is his ability to explain, you know, how art works and how the artist works.
Oh yeah, because you've got the two sides of the spectrum in their essence with your students, where you are showing them how to contact that tender creative impulse within themselves and begin this avenue of expression. And then as a gallery owner, you're at the other side of, you know, as you say, picking up the artifacts and communicating those and bringing those to the general public. So I can see why that lifestyle as an artist would be fulfilling for you, because, you know, you really are encompassing the whole ball game.
Well, that is the story. I mean, I was forced, whether I wanted to or not, to look at the big picture. Mm-hmm. And the big picture is this creative loop from cognition and inception, going alone, being alone, and bringing this thing into manifestation. And then as a teacher, I teach that whole process, and I had to go through that to see the whole picture. And then the connecting is the what happens with the gallery. And so I'm involved with making the process work. See, if there's any breakdown at any point, if the artist can't go deep enough, if he can only stay on the surface level, if he can't leave the specifics of this world and go to that universal realm that these more unified cognitions come from, well, it's fine. He's a decorative artist. He's making decorative things, and it's fine. But there's this, so I have to bring to the artist's awareness their role and what the potential for that is. Then I have to teach the language of visual expression to bring artists into the create artists, and then we have the artifacts of that whole thing. Now, if there's any breakdown, as I was saying, in this, if the language level is not complete, if the artist's understanding of where he can operate from, if he doesn't know how to operate from the subtle, fine. I mean, he's making surfacey art, but if he can operate from the subtle, then we really are working from where the artist, as a shamanic being, can work from. But then he has to have the language of expression, the means, and the understanding of media. And then we have to have that place where it all comes together, and the group is essentially healed through the product of the artist's endeavors.
That's very interesting, because just again reflecting on my own children who are both very creative. One of them, my daughter Adrienne, she was one of these people who knew what she wanted to be when she grew up, when she was 5-6 years old. And from the age of 13 especially, she was just like a laser beam. She was going to be in musical theater, and she's still in that, you know, absolutely focused on that. My son Dane, on the other hand, his impulse was just to create, and he's been like all, and it didn't matter to him whether he changed all the time. He was just, you know, sometimes visual artist, sometimes photographer, sometimes musician, clothing artist, everything. But he did reach a point where instead of having it all there in his own room and just doing it all privately for his own benefit, he felt greater joy in bringing it out in some form. So whether it was selling art on the streets of Chicago on a little table, or whether it was with his little band playing in abandoned factories and inviting an audience or taking his little band on tour. It seems like that impulse is as natural to share and communicate one's expressions as it is to express them in the first place.
Yeah, I think both things are part of the whole process.
Yeah, we're talking about a convergence of many different continua. You know, one is whether the artist is expressing in a context that has a sufficient universality so there is a wide audience. Mm-hmm. Another one is whether what he is expressing is profound enough to be moving to the audience. The audience may be delighted or the audience may be deeply moved. It may be memorable or and unforgettable, or it may be simply delightful. And so there are all kinds of different continua of the creativity and the domain in which you're being creative and the way in which an artist is expressing himself may be very different from the way audiences come to the artist to be affected by it, which is the communication end of it. Mm-hmm. And if an artist is motivated to make a connection with an audience, then certain art forms will be more appealing than others. And if it's in the cards for you to be a painter, but you need to have a really direct connection with your audience, then you have a special challenge that a lot of painters may not have to deal with. Mm-hmm. Just as if you're a performance artist and you don't care at all about the audience, you'll be perfectly happy to do your performance in an empty garage. And, you know, people will only find out that you did it, and that's sufficient for, you can tell them, I bit the head off a chicken, and people will say, wow, that's amazing, how could you do that? And you've sort of made your statement, but nobody ever actually had to be there and see it, which in that case might be a good thing.
Well, it comes back to what you're saying about language, which I was actually, when I started mentioning my kids, that was one of the points I was going to make, is that they each had their own specific language of creativity. But what you were just saying addresses the element of language, that language is for communication, and the greater you have mastery over language, the deeper and more subtle things you can express in that language. I'm trying to learn to speak French, and I'm feeling very proud of myself because I can walk down the street and narrate my experience to myself in French. But what I'm saying is things like, there are many gray cars.
Right.
The trees are big.
Right.
And so I can't really have a conversation with somebody like this in French because...
Right, it's so this points out the value of the teacher mm-hmm. and learning the language.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
If you're going to want to say something about the visual, symbolic, cognitive world that's inside you, you need to speak the visual mm-hmm. language of art. And that's what I teach. And because society will often want you to talk about it in words. So you do the best, and maybe you'll end up being a poet or a writer or something in that attempt, but you're still maybe referring to a visual, symbolic kind of world that's inside that is best addressed through the language of visual art itself. And that means understanding the structure of the visual illusion, mm-hmm. that is light and dark and pattern and the color issues and all of this, understanding how a visual manifestation is structured. Then you have to have skill in manipulating these gross media that we have available to us in this gross material world to construct a world of those elements. Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't easy. This takes some time. But if you want to express yourself on the piano and play Liszt or something, you've got to do some practicing and you've got to learn that piano first. So there's varying degrees of skill in using the language. I mean, there are people who, a French man can woo a woman with few words mm-hmm. if he's a good lover. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to like master every grammatical element of French to be artful, or to be a lover, to be...
It's worth mentioning, I think, that Samuel Beckett chose to write in French, largely because it prevented him from intellectualizing and waxing effulgent. Wow. It forced him to be simple and direct. And he wrote Waiting for Godot in French and other works, and then translated them into English.
Fascinating. That's really fascinating. And another thing I thought of, Bill, when you were talking before about the artist speaking and expressing in the visual language, it's always been very intriguing to me to watch these films of great artists talking about their work, because since their profundity, you know, of expression is in the visual field, sometimes they really have a hard time finding the words to explain it. And yet, like you were just saying with Samuel Beckett, it's almost more charming that their words are few and simple. Yeah. They'll be saying, you know, it almost seems like they're struggling to find the words, and yet they're almost like little pearls of wisdom in their simplicity.
Well, and I'm almost ready to publish a small book of poetry, and the few people I've been showing it to get critical feedback, you know, a few of them have said, well, this one is interesting, but I really don't understand what it's about. And it's a classic conundrum for a poet. You know, could I explain it? Mm-hmm. And in some cases, the answer is no, I can't explain it. If I could say it in prose, I would have not written a poem. Mm-hmm. I wrote it in that form because that was the only way I could get it out into the world. And there, it wasn't something that has an equivalent. Mm-hmm. And the same is very much true of paintings. I mean, you can look at a painting and say, yeah, that's a beautiful, you know, country scene, and it doesn't need explaining in a sense. But what's really exciting and moving about that painting isn't the fact that there's a barn in it or a hill or a cornfield. It's the relationship. It's something that you really can't explain. And the more time you spend explaining it, the less it is the painting.
Which circles back to our original point of that impulse within you that made you want to say that in a poem.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.